Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, a podcast where I normally record from the comfort of my own home and get guests to either come in and sit with me in my living room, or else we connect over the internet. But right now, I am sitting for the first time in Queenswood in London, on top of a hill, in the sun, and you may be able to hear birds around me. Sometimes they land above me. And this is an experiment in recording outdoors. I'm hoping to do a series of experiments where I record in different contexts with different people. So lately I've recorded quite a few conversations with different conversation partners. This weekend just gone, I recorded with Rob Knight about meditation, and I also recorded with my friend Delia on her podcast Growing Up, which I will link in the show notes. I have also recently been awarded a fellowship from the Interintellect, and many of the guests that I've had on this podcast, including Jake Orthwine, Rob Knight, and Isabella Granick, are people that I know through this online community called the Interintellect, which is spread all over the world, but there's great people in it, both in London and elsewhere. In terms of philosophy, I've really been all over the place. I'm slowly reading Spinoza. I'm kind of tempted to dip into Hume. I'm still reading Schopenhauer. And it's probably worth going into what I'm up to with each of those people. So Spinoza I'm interested in because he is an anti-teleological thinker. He thinks that humans have goals, but the nature or God, which are equivalent for Spinoza, do not. He's writing in what's now the Netherlands. He came from the Iberian Peninsula, where his family did, and he's writing in the 17th century. I'm also reading Schopenhauer, as I mentioned, The World is Will and Representation, both volumes. The second kind of comments on the first volume, or at least in the sections that I'm reading, that's how it's structured. And Schopenhauer, as I may have alluded to in some of these previous conversations, is looking at a kind of division between the intuition, and he thinks perception is deeply related to that, and reason. And so I'll be talking more about how those relate to time and space in the near future. He's also very helpful because he's given quite a good overview of philosophy, including on the topic of teleology. He thinks there are three great thinkers and a bunch of imitators who deny teleology, and he accuses them of doing so for theological reasons. Those people are, in time order, Lucretius, the Epicurean philosopher, Francis Bacon, born in the 16th century, and Spinoza, born in the 17th century. Whereas Schopenhauer himself is in favor of teleology. He thinks it's too obvious to be denied, and that the people who deny it are kind of doing this for biased reasons, something to do with speculative theology. I don't really understand fully his charge against them. But as you may have gathered from previous conversations, this is an idea that I am going against. And I think that it's in line with Darwinian thinking, which is that random selection and variation is what produces change rather than top-down ordering principles. Now, it's not that there aren't any emergent top-down effects, but that in general, these come quite late, whereas change, at least initially, tends to come from the bottom up. And I think that's a general point, so I would apply it both to life and to physics and to human stuff as well. So that's why I'm looking at Schopenhauer. I'm also very tempted to read David Hume, and that's partly because he calls into question whether causation is as straightforward as it seems to us. So seems pretty obvious that we can do things that have these effects, but he doesn't see that there's any guarantee that just because something has worked 1,000 times that it won't do something different on the 1001st try. So taken to the extreme, we could say, well, the laws of physics are just things that we observe to be true. And if you imagine that we drop a rock 1,000 times in a row and it falls every time, but then the 1001st time we drop it and it doesn't fall, well, then we're going to have to go with that result, as in our view of physics will need to account for what's happened there. And this is the problem of induction, which is that we seem to know these regularities as they exist out there, and yet there's no real guarantee that just because something has happened previously, it will happen again. And while that may seem far-fetched in physics, there are other places where it might be more obvious. There's the kind of black swan example, which is just because all the swans we've seen are white doesn't mean that every swan will always be white. You could imagine something like multicellularity, right? Up until a certain point in the evolution of life, everything is single cellular. So you might say an organism or life itself is this cell-like thing that behaves more or less independently, and maybe there's a bit of a spectrum and some of them cooperate or something like that, but there isn't a kind of integrated whole level of multicellular organism yet, right? But that doesn't mean that it's in principle impossible, right? So you can see the kind of contradictions that come from induction, because we're basing what we think a law is on what we observe to be the case. Now, what is the case is always going to win out over any given law, right? So you could think of areas of physics where that's happened, where we get these unexpected effects when using Newtonian mechanics, and we get something else in these kind of like edge cases. And so the solution can't be to say, well, the law has to be right, because if we're observing these things, then we're going to have to revise the laws. So that's just what I'm vaguely aware of Hume doing. And the other reason I'm interested in Hume is because Christopher Beckwith thinks that he's an early example of someone who's quite influenced by Pyrrhonist thinking. You may also have heard of me talking about Pyrrhonist skepticism. This guy, Pyrrho of Elis, born in the 4th century BC, dies in the 3rd century BC, and accompanies Alexander the Great into India. In Beckwith's argument, when he reaches India, he's influenced by Buddhism, but whether he is or not, there are certain interesting similarities between the Pyrrhonist skeptic position and the Buddhist position, especially for me, that they both seem to navigate a kind of middle way between reifying concepts, which just means to make a concept real, so coming up with some kind of concept and then viewing that as something existent out there, and the denial that anything can be known outside. So in Buddhism, these two extremes are called eternalism, where you kind of view yourself as this static thing that progresses through time, or you view a concept as a kind of clean-cut category where you can put things in that category and it must exist in some kind of universal form, whether that universal form is in its own realm, as the kind of caricature of Platonism would have us think, or whether universals somehow inhere in their particulars, as a realist like Charles Sanders Peirce would have us think. He thinks that's required for science to work. And the opposite extreme, which Peirce calls nominalism, and there's a kind of intermediate one called conceptualism, which he thinks is also a form of nominalism. And conceptualism just says, look, concepts exist, but only in our minds. We use them to categorize the experiences we encounter, but they don't exist in the things out there. The most extreme opposite stage is called nominalism, which just says that concepts are just words. They have no existence either in reality nor even in our mind. And so they're just kind of these fictional things. They don't really apply to anything. And that's the most extreme denial of any kind of universal. Now, both the Buddhists and the Pyrrhonists reject both extremes. And I think in the case of Buddhism, they're rejecting the idea that the self persists as a kind of static soul or something like that that drives the action of an individual. And they also go against this idea of annihilationism or nihilism, which is to say that there is no soul or we have no continuity between one moment and the next. The Buddhists kind of say both of these are wrong. And I think the Pyrrhonists do something similar, which is more to do with concepts broadly speaking than just the self. So they are denying either that the universals exist in some kind of Platonic realm, and they are denying that universals don't exist. That may be a stretch, that may be my own interpretation of what's going on in Pyrrhonism, but I think there is a kind of tendency to fight these extremes. And I think this is important because I think danger lies in either of these extremes. Relating again to Pyrrhonism, and Pyrrhonism again is this form of skepticism. It is designed, as I just said, to combat concepts, but I might say that one way to understand it is as fighting dogmatism in oneself. So rather than taking a dogmatic position, something that can never be proved conclusively, let's say the soul exists or the soul doesn't exist or God exists or God doesn't exist or the will is free or the will is not free. I think those are ones that Kant points to as things that can never really be decided either. And he may, I've never really heard this argued, but possibly he's responding to this same kind of debate. And so the reason I say that is because for the Pyrrhonists, they would take a question like, does the soul exist? And they would say, well, some people say it does, some people say it doesn't, and it doesn't seem to be decidable on the basis of opinion. But rather than taking the epistemological position that we can never have knowledge about the soul, they are taking a pragmatic position, which is to say that holding either of these true will eventually cause suffering. So if you say the soul definitely exists, well, then you're going to suffer when people deny that it exists. And if you say that the soul definitely doesn't exist, then you're going to suffer when people claim that it does exist. So in my understanding of what the Pyrrhonists are up to, this is an ethical, pragmatic stance that is designed to prevent dogmatism and to prevent dogmatic views on non-evident matters from arising in ourselves. They believe that through this practice of undermining dogmatic views, we first reach epoche, which is the suspension of judgment, and eventually it will lead to ataraxia, which is unperturbedness or just not being bothered about things. So these guys are writing from, like, let's say the 3rd century BC to the 2nd or maybe 3rd century AD, period of about 500 or 600 years. From the beginning, or at least we have evidence that in antiquity this was not a popular view. A lot of people didn't like it for one reason or another. In particular, they thought that it might be contradictory. So to say that no stance should ever be taken is itself a stance. Now, the later Pyrrhonists kind of come up with arguments about why this isn't the case, and they try and give examples like, you could imagine a fire that burns down a forest and then burns itself out. So, in other words, this is a tactical deployment of arguments in order to cause a problem to stop. It is not itself a position. It's just a kind of technique. I think more specifically they say it's like a hurricane that can wipe out a town, and after the town is wiped out, the hurricane blows itself out or something like that. So it's a kind of destructive force and it has no positive program. Now, one reason I'm interested in skepticism is because they were translated into Latin in the 1560s, and specifically this guy Sextus Empiricus. And there's a scholar, Richard Popkin, whose work I have not yet read, who tries to argue that this kicks off a Pironian crisis, which shifts philosophy from questions of theology and ontology, the old questions of what is out there, how is it ordered, into an epistemological question, which is, how do we know things? And I think this is something that kind of happened earlier in Greek philosophy too. I just kind of have that sense, you know, when you think of Thales of Miletus and Anaximander and Heraclitus and all those early pre-Socratic guys, the kind of commonplace tale, which I think is slightly inaccurate, but maybe not entirely inaccurate, is that what they're interested in is what exists or what reality is or what things are made of. Democritus would be another one that probably falls into this category. And later Greek philosophy starts to get more interested in how can we know things. And that seems to again happen in European philosophy. So people like Spinoza, even though he's sort of writing in the wake of this Pironian crisis, kind of use words in a way that suggests that they don't think language is too problematic. They're like, okay, a percept is what comes in from the outside, a concept is what comes out from the inside, and that's how things are structured, you know, and they don't think about, well, where do these words come from? How do we know we agree on the definitions? There's a kind of assumption that words can be used relatively transparently and unproblematically, and that comes under increasing stress leading pretty much up to the 20th century with people like Wittgenstein, who are really trying to get to the bottom of what language does and doesn't do and how to understand it. As an aside, Walter Kaufmann, whom you may know as one of Nietzsche's translators, thinks that this idea that Wittgenstein has of family resemblances as a way of understanding words has its origins in Nietzsche, who thinks that words are like these pockets or bags full of stuff where you just chuck random things in there. And you can think of words that have this kind of hodgepodge character. Quite often the most simple words in a language are very flexible. You know, you look at the dictionary for set or put, and there's just all kinds of things that either one of those words can mean. I have actually found a passage of Schopenhauer somewhere where he says an almost identical thing, which is obviously Schopenhauer's writing before Nietzsche, really had a big influence on Nietzsche. So, yeah, that's just to say that people are quite well aware by the early 19th century that there are some problems with language, right? And Nietzsche, whom I've quoted before, I think it's in the Gay Science, as saying, all concepts equate the unequal. He's seeing that there is a kind of problem in this level of abstraction. Abstraction is another way that I think the Pyrrhonists are quite important, because they make this division between evident and non-evident matters. So even though already in antiquity they're kind of made fun of for potentially not having a view about whether they should get out of the way of a cart that's oncoming. Pyrrho of Elis is described as having to be guided by his friends so as not to be hit by carts or horses that are coming along, and also that they have to prevent him from falling in ditches, the kind of implication being that he has no view about whether it's better to fall in a ditch or not. But in fact, that looks like it's probably already a misrepresentation of what the Pyrrhonists are actually on about. By the time of Sextus Empiricus, around 200 AD, we think, it's very uncertain, a lot of these Pyrrhonists seem to be doctors, so they seem quite capable of operating and functioning in the world. And it may even be the case that they, as empiricists, and it's not a clean mapping of empiricism onto Pyrrhonism, but there is a relationship, potentially, that they are actually doctors who have better outcomes than the other school, who are called dogmatists. And they come from a kind of top-down, first principles, here's what we know about the body and here's what should be done on first principles kind of thing. Whereas the empiricists are much more experimental. They use trial and error. And you can see that a lot of my interests relate to this question of, is it abstract or is it concrete? Is it pushing in the direction of laws and rules, or is it pushing in the direction of the uniqueness of experience? And that may sound a bit woo or just kind of vague, and maybe at this point it is, but I'm eventually going to argue, using this idea that I have about neither nor, that neither the one or the other, as in neither the rationalist mode nor the empiricist mode on its own, is sufficient. That may seem obvious when I put it that way, but there are lots and lots of different domains that I'm going to go into and try and argue how this applies to things like, you may have heard on recent podcasts, Buddhist doctrines like dependent origination, potentially even arguments in biology, maybe the difference between Lamarck and Darwin, or even the differences between geology. I think there might be something in that, catastrophism versus uniformitarianism, if you're familiar with that debate. And I have on this podcast already gone a little bit into the historical sciences. How do we know why the dinosaurs went extinct, and how do we get very, very certain about the answer to that question, which is ultimately a historical question about what happened, versus how do we reach certainty through lab experiments or other kinds of repeatable experiments that allow us to get certainty via a very different methodology and a very different way of reasoning. So that's a roundabout way of saying that I'm also reading Michel de Montaigne, as well as Blaise Pascal, who seem to be quite impacted by these translations of Pyrrhonist doctrines as found in Sextus Empiricus into Latin in the 1560s. And if you know about Michel de Montaigne, you may know that he's very, very well read in the classics. There's some story about he was raised only in Latin, and therefore his mother tongue is Latin. I've never quite understood exactly whether that was true, or it seems a little unlikely based on some other conflicting things that suggest that he was able to understand French from an early age. But there may be something to it, which is that he was exceptionally well schooled in both Latin and ancient Greek. Pascal, who's writing a little bit later than Montaigne, but is very influenced by him, is another person that I'm reading, the Pensées, or Thoughts. They are very good. And all of these are pointing in the same direction. Nietzsche is also pointing in the same direction. I finished Genealogy of Morality in the past few months, and I'm moving on to Ecce Homo, which is quite funny if you haven't read it. And I'm also looking at the Tao Te Ching, because in the late 20th century, there were discoveries of very, very old copies of the Tao Te Ching, the Chinese text which is credited to Laozi, and may be from sort of the 4th or 5th century BC. But I believe it's quite hard to date the Tao Te Ching with any more certainty than that. And Taoism is another source of this idea that there are two fundamental ways of attending. And you may hear something of Ian McGilchrist in there, and I think he's an important source for looking at some of these divides as well. So where do I build on McGilchrist? Well, one thing that I'm pushing towards, and it may not be completely clear yet, is that there are systematic ways of recognizing when we go too far in one mode of reasoning or the other, and that there are practices that you can actually use in order to reverse directions in terms of these ordering principles. Now, McGilchrist is absolutely brilliant. He tends to focus a little more on the Western philosophy, at least in The Master and His Emissary, which I have read. I have yet to read The Matter with Things, so that may have changed in the past decade or so. You may also know that I've been quite influenced by both Thomas Kuhn and Julian Jaynes. And I would say that I see Kuhn's historicizing approach as well as Jaynes's almost archaeological approach as being very similar to mine. So I seek to historicize ideas and concepts and words, and I also seek to kind of unearth earlier ways of being in the world. So I sometimes like to think of that as a kind of cognitive archaeology. Questions like, how old is the self? How old is suffering or unsatisfactoriness or anxiety or depression? Now you may think, well, it's obvious, these are as old as anatomical modernity. As soon as humans have brains that are as large as our brains, and in fact, human brains, I believe, have been shrinking, so they may even have been larger, then you may just think, well, they had all the same kinds of experiences and concepts and issues that we did. Whereas Jaynes would say, something must have changed, given that gods, spirits, demons, magical forces were pretty much a human universal before a certain point, and now they no longer seem to be. So from Jaynes's point of view, the simplest explanation is that cognition itself has changed. Consciousness itself has changed. And by consciousness, he means something like self-consciousness, not just strictly awareness. Again, this may seem far-fetched, but if we agree that our primate relatives don't have the same sort of self or the same level of suffering that we have, then something must have changed. And again, I'm using the kind of Buddhist definition of suffering. So this is not an ability to experience direct pain, but a kind of second order narrative that comes alongside pain. If we say that, for example, perhaps other apes don't have this, or it doesn't really matter where we draw the line, we could well include apes and dolphins and corvids or, you know, many other animals. But if we can at least agree that, for example, cats don't have the same type of self, sense of self, existential suffering that humans have, then there must be some history to how this situation has come about. And that's going to involve a historical examination of the evidence and the application of conditional reasoning to understand how is it the case that we now have this certain mode of cognition and thinking about ourselves and projecting theory of mind onto others. I'm not going to say that this is brand new, like it just came out yesterday or something, but I'm also not going to assume that it's built into the brain, but that it arises contingent on conditions, and that even things that we think are very basic, things like language, may use parts of the brain that are partially co-evolved for that purpose, but that the brain can't have been designed in order to speak, that language cannot be the telos of evolution, because, as I've been kind of suggesting throughout, evolution does not have any telos. That's a very high-level overview of what I've been up to for the past few months. And if any of this sounds interesting, I would love to speak to you, so please do reach out. Just let me know that you've heard this, because sometimes I release the podcast and I just have no idea. It kind of goes off into this weird void. So I love hearing from listeners, so please get in touch. If any of these areas is an area where you're an expert or just have a great interest, I would also love to speak to you on the podcast, so please get in touch. And if you're interested in attending any events, I will be hosting Interintellect Salons, both in person in London, as well as online for the Interintellect. And if you just want to stay in the loop and hear roughly what I'm up to, I do have a Substack, that's briancam.substack.com. And finally, if you would like to financially support the show for as little as £5 a month, please go to my Patreon, where you will get frequent updates and some exclusive content as we go forward. I also have not been working for the past few years. If there is any job you know of or any fellowships I should apply for, basically anything that provides income and seems like it might be compatible to you with the kind of work that I'm doing, I would also love to hear about any opportunities or fellowships or grants or things like that that might be able to support this work. So thank you very much for listening. Thanks for supporting me. I love recording these episodes. I hope the outdoor episode went reasonably okay. It was quite calming to do it out here. A few people walked by with dogs or quite close to me. I'm pretty far up in the hills. It's not really like a thoroughfare, but a few people did come by. So it's been a nice place to record. I kind of like the peace of it. And I did not bring my phone out here, so there's something to that as well. I am recording on a portable Zoom field recorder if you are the kind of person who is curious about that kind of thing. So I would love to hear from you. Looking forward to seeing you in London or online on the events that I'm hosting for Interintellect. And if you want to hear about those events, please get on Substack or Patreon. Until next time.